Shrink Wrap Radio number 423, Integrating Psychology into Primary Care with Dr. Susan H. McDaniel.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Susan H. McDaniel, a highly published and award-winning psychologist who is currently running for president of the American Psychological Association on a platform that emphasizes better integration of psychology into overall health care. For more information about Dr. Susan McDaniel, please see our show notes for this episode at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Susan McDaniel, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm really happy to have this opportunity to speak with you. And as a voting member of the American Psychological Association, I saw your statement of candidacy for the office of APA president, and I was intrigued by your platform. And so I thought, hey, maybe I can set up an interview.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you are intrigued, and I'm happy to talk about it.
Well, by the way, are the election results in yet?
So the election runs for 6 long weeks, David. So it's opened on September 15th, and it closes on October 29th.
Oh, boy. So you're on tenterhooks that long.
That's right. It's a really long time. So for anybody who's an APA member and hasn't voted yet, you still have plenty of time.
Okay, great. And I would encourage them to, particularly after they hear this interview, I'm sure they'll rush off and
I hope
vote.
So. Yeah, right.
Well, let's go back into your professional history a bit. Am I correct that you've actually been working in family medicine for your entire career at the University of Rochester?
So, right. I did my clinical psychology PhD at UNC Chapel Hill, and I did an internship at University of Texas Medical Branch and a postdoctoral fellowship at Texas Research Institute for Mental Sciences in Houston. Both of those focused on family therapy. And then in 1980, I moved to Rochester, where I've been at the medical center since I finished my postdoc.
Yeah, so what's your position there now?
So at this point, all along I've been 60% in psychiatry, 40% in family medicine. So I sort of straddle mental health and primary care both for all these years. And right now I'm a division chief in psychiatry of something called the Institute for the Family, and I'm the associate chair of family medicine.
Yes, well, you have quite a history of accolades, honors, offices, etc. And I know you've done some notable things in the family medicine program. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Well, I think that probably what I'm most, well, two things in family medicine. The first 10 years, I really spent a lot of time working with my family physician colleague, Tom Campbell, trying to apply psychological principles to everyday primary care practice. So trying to figure out what the primary care residents and physicians need to know about how to diagnose and take the best care of their patients with psychological issues, whether they're behavioral health issues about healthy lifestyles or their actual mental illness issues like depression, anxiety, panic, PTSD, all of which are highly common in a primary care population. So I spent a lot of time on that. But as we began getting good at screening for depression and anxiety, I was working with the residents around making referrals to community practitioners and having a hard time getting my community colleagues to communicate back and collaborate with these physicians about mm-hmm. the patients. So, and I work in an underserved clinic, poor, disadvantaged, underserved inner city clinic. And so we sort of just stumbled into deciding to try to provide some of these mental health and behavioral health services on site in the primary care clinic. And that was 1985. There really weren't very many regulations or insurance issues about doing that at that time. And so we just experimented and were amazed at how well that eliminated the communication barriers, the access barriers for patients who didn't want to have to go somewhere else and who might have difficulty getting somewhere else.
Now, what is the that you're referring to, that solved those problems?
Having mental health services provided in the primary care clinic.
Okay.
So having what's now called an integrated care clinic, and having mental and behavioral health services provided right where the patient comes to get their primary care.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, there's been a long history of competition for turf between psychology and medicine, especially psychiatry. And here you are with having now for some time having had an appointment in psychiatry and working regularly with psychiatry. Have those sorts of issues gone away? And what about all the questions within psychology about the medical model and whether that's a good thing or not a good thing?
Okay, so those are two important questions. Yeah. And if I get lost, bring me back to the second one.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, I don't think the turf battles, especially at a national level, and even to some extent at a local level for me, have gone away. And the fact that integrated care and delivering behavioral and mental health services in primary care and in other medical settings is now, in the last few years, become something that everybody's decided is a good thing. Now everybody's trying to scramble for a piece of the pie. When I started in the 80s, family medicine and psychiatry were having a hard time getting along, and psychiatry felt family medicine didn't adequately refer patients that needed their services, and family medicine felt that psychiatry didn't understand that their patients, when they referred them, usually wouldn't go to some other location. So just a lot of misunderstandings. And certainly living in the context makes it much easier to understand what they're up against. I think the issue of psychology and psychiatry, I'm lucky to be in a psychiatry department that's had a long history of psychology leaders. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I probably have a better situation than many. But there's also the whole issue of what about master's level providers? So psychologists can get worried about both psychiatrists and master's level clinicians.
Right. So we're looking up the ladder, and we're looking down at the ladder at who's coming.
Right. That's mm-hmm. right. So but from my perspective, since I work with all those people in primary care, my perspective is even if you use all those people that we have, we still can't meet the need of the patients in our community to receive mental and behavioral health services. So I think there's plenty of work for all of us in these settings, and that the issue is trying to figure out to have some role clarity. What is each of us good for? You know, in some of those areas, we overlap, like Venn diagrams. You know, certainly there's some things that psychiatrists and psychologists both can do, and some things that are very distinct. And then with psychologists and master's level people, there's some things we both can do, and there's some things that are very distinct. So I think it's really important that each discipline really go through a self-study about, you know, what should be their role in primary care, and what are they, what does their skill set make them good at, a previous APA president, Suzanne Bennett Johnson, put together an interorganizational task force to develop the primary care psychology competencies, and I chaired that group. And that report is published in the May-June American Psychologist, and we really went through a fairly laborious process of deciding what are the competencies for primary care psychology. And I, you know, perhaps the other disciplines, psychiatry, social work, marriage and family therapy, counselors, are involved in the same process. I hope so, because I think that we need to understand each other and, you know, complement each other's services with the patient at the center rather than fight about turf. But that's much easier said than done when the financial resources are limited. Sure. So
when I was coming up, which was a long time ago, psychologists in that sort of a setting, supposedly the expertise of the psychologist was twofold: psychological testing, and along with that, suggesting a diagnosis, and research. So after the work of your committee, have those competencies been expanded? And if so, how so?
Definitely. Certainly, many psychologists still do testing in primary care. Some don't. I don't, but it's a good thing to have. And certainly, some psychologists do research in primary care. I do that. And that's very important. But there's a whole range of other things that I think psychologists are good for, including consulting on complex cases, seeing some of the complex cases themselves, supervising master's level clinicians and care managers, helping to develop the ongoing quality improvement projects that primary care physicians must be involved in, helping facilitate team functioning. Primary care is now delivered, is really team-based care, not individual provider-based care. And how for these teams to optimize their functioning is not altogether clear at this point in time. So having somebody who understands teams and how to help teams function better is very helpful. Leadership coaching for the variety of especially doctoral level people in leadership roles is another thing that we can do in addition to the things you mentioned.
Okay, yeah, well, that definitely expands it quite a bit. And by the way, just parenthetically, I want to share with you that one of my sons has recently become a nurse practitioner, and he works in a team environment like that. And yep. I have to say my admiration for nursing and nurse practitioners really has skyrocketed as a result of meeting the faculty at UCSF that trained him and the kind of ethos that nursing as a profession has.
So UCSF has a particularly fine nursing school of nursing. I know some of the people there. Mm-hmm. And NPs are very important to the new organization of primary care. There just aren't enough primary care physicians to meet the need that is put forward by the Affordable Care Act. And having our nurse practitioners in our family medicine clinic now have their own panel of patients. We have developed an NP enhanced orientation, kind of a residency for nurse practitioners who are coming out of school so that they can have more training in primary care. They're a very important part of the workforce.
Yeah, I mentioned that because I listened to a presentation that you gave that's on YouTube, and I could tell from your remarks that you were very respectful of the contribution of nurse practitioners. So I thought I'd slip that in.
Yeah, that's great. Good for your son, and I hope a lot of other bright young people will also become NPs. I'm the person who sort of supports and manages the NPs in our clinic and tries to help them with this new development of an NP residency after graduation. So I'm sort of embedded in it right now. And I was on the board of advisors for the Duke School of Nursing for 6 years. So that was my education. I would say before that, I didn't know so much about nursing, but I got an education doing that.
Yes, I'll bet you did. Now, coming back to that question of the medical model, and you know, there's the medical model there, and there's what counterpoise to that might be more of an educational model, I guess. And then attached to that, maybe as a separate question, is the role of big pharma and the nervousness that many psychologists have about being within this, working within the sphere of influence of big pharma. I hear you taking a big breath.
Part of that is, I thought what you were going to say is the nervousness many psychologists have working with the medical model and especially physicians.
But yeah, go wherever.
You said big pharma, so that surprised me a little bit. Not that they're completely independent, but they should be.
Yeah.
Okay, so I do think that part of what psychology and other non-medical mental health clinicians have to offer primary care or other medical settings for that matter is a biopsychosocial approach, a comprehensive, whole person, contextualized approach to care that patients can only benefit from. Having a very, you know, unless you're going to have a cyst removed or something, and even then, I think a biopsychosocial approach is superior to just a biotechnical approach. And certainly in primary care, that's important. So I think we bring that with us, and that's valued certainly by my colleagues. Now, it takes a while to get to that place. Sometimes it's as if, you know, they're speaking Russian and we're speaking English, and it can be hard to understand each other. I'm doing a physician communication coaching program across the medical center and spending time in a lot of other departments right now than just family medicine. So it typically will take a while before the physician who recognizes that I have a PhD instead of an MD after my name to decide that I have something worthwhile to offer them. And I mean, not that long. It's just that it takes me a while to get them to meet with me because they're skeptical. Mm-hmm. And then after we've had our time together, then they want to know when they can meet with me again. So it doesn't take that long. It's more, you know, getting to first base can be difficult.
Yeah.
So I think that what we have to offer is part of what healthcare so badly needs. And I think our biggest challenge is getting our foot in the door. Usually after that, physicians, NPs, and other members of the team recognize that our skills are typically in a different area than theirs, and also makes their particular job so much easier because they're not feeling responsible for taking care of what they know is a panic attack in some patient when they really don't have the skill set to do that. Mm-hmm. But they may be treating her for pregnancy or something like that. So I think it's a matter of getting the opportunity to demonstrate what we can do. And it's certainly different than having a private psychotherapy practice. It's very different than having a private psychotherapy practice, but it is very rewarding. And we often see patients that wouldn't otherwise see us, you know, that feel comfortable seeing us because their physician says, you know, I like for my patients with your particular problem to work with Dr. McDaniel. She's a psychologist and let me have you meet her before you leave today. And she's been very helpful to many of my patients. And then once they meet you and see that you're not crazy, which is their imagination, then they'll often come back, as opposed to a blind referral to someone across town who they don't know. And, you know, I think less than 50% of referrals from physicians actually successfully land on our doorsteps.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is making me wonder a little bit about the supply of psychologists into this kind of an environment. I think for a long time, kind of the gold standard in graduate student imagination was private practice.
Right.
And that their imagination, they weren't imagining settings like this. I don't know if that's changed or not. Tell us a little bit about those issues.
Well, I think in terms of workforce, we are certainly behind in terms of being able to actually meet the need of people, which is partly why if you wanted to be psychology-centric, it wouldn't make sense because we're not producing enough psychologists to meet the need. And I think we really, even if you include the master's level people, of whom there are many more, we still aren't meeting the need. So I think that, like I said before, there's room for everyone. Whether people are getting this exposure and training in graduate school is highly variable. I hope that all students at least know it's a possibility and can search for training at the internship or postdoc level if they are practitioners. I'm not even confident that's always true, but hopefully if they belong to APA, the graduate student part of APA, then certainly they get the mailings that have plenty of information about primary care as an opportunity. But there's some places that are really great at it that do have courses at the graduate level. Certainly graduate students in health psychology, even that has traditionally been a specialty oriented, you know, cardiology, cancer, those kind of areas, which are great places to work for sure, but less organized around primary care. But I think all health psychology students now are exposed to primary care. It's the clinical counseling, family, other kinds of practicing psychologists that it's variable whether they have some opportunity to both have seminars and practicum training in primary care.
I was a little surprised to hear you say that we're underproducing therapists. Somehow I had the impression that maybe graduate schools were turning out too many, and that may have more to do with the emphasis of so many doctoral programs wanting to turn out people who essentially the only job that would be available for them would be to be a professor, and there aren't that many.
Well, a professor or an independent practice. I mean, these are projections about how we manage population health through the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, most psychologists are not being trained to do the kind of work we're talking about right now. So I think that's, you know, that's part of the issue, is that where people are trained and believe they want to go is not here, and that's why we're underproducing people for this particular job.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a paper by Ben Miller in the American Psychologist May June special issue on psychology and primary care on workforce issues. If people are interested, he maps that out.
Okay. And you've touched on this, but just in case there's any more juice here, what can psychologists learn from medicine, and what can doctors learn from psychologists?
Well, there's a huge amount on both sides. I went into family medicine thinking that I was there to, you know, convert the natives. And I hope I have done that to a certain extent. But what I learned along the way was that there's a considerable conversion process in the other direction. I think that what we have to offer them, and the more they understand about psychology and psychosocial issues in medicine, the better collaborators they are. Some people in the old days used to say, you know, don't teach medical students all that psychology, you're just giving it away. But it's so complicated that it definitely is better to have someone that knows something about anxiety, depression, etc., and what makes humans tick, as somebody to collaborate with. And I think we have that to offer. They can learn about how to really think about a biopsychosocial model, and how to screen for depression and how to talk to patients. We have a lot to offer in the communication and interviewing realm. How to take care of themselves, self-awareness, work-family balance, team functioning. There's sort of an endless research, an endless number of things that I think we have to offer them. What I've learned, what I think people learn from working in medicine is we're sometimes weak on the bio part of the biopsychosocial model, and understanding better how biologic and physiologic process interacts with individual and interpersonal dynamics is very important. And seeing the social determinants of health, whether it's poverty or family dynamics or community statistics or, you know, climate change, you name it, how they affect health is very important for us to understand. And public health issues, how to think about delivering health care to a population. So I think there's a number of things we learn from them. We also learn how to be quicker and more concise, which is more difficult than what we learn in psychology graduate school, which is take your time, think about it a lot, write a lot. You know, none of that is appreciated in a fast-paced primary care situation. And I think it's much harder to be brief and quick than it is to be considered and, you know, more lengthy.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah, I think Mark Twain said, I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time. And that's really true.
Yeah, we hear about CEOs these days that won't read anything longer than a one-page memo.
Well, for sure, physicians won't read anything longer than a paragraph. So the way I was taught to write psychological evaluations, virtually nobody would pay any attention to at this point in time. If you shadow them and see what their work life is like, which anybody interested in doing this work should definitely do, you can see why. There really isn't the time if you're going to serve. And now we've got all these that many more insured patients to care for, there just isn't the time. So it's important to be able to boil it down to the important principles that you want the person to understand about the patient, and then just tell them what you think they ought to do. That's what they want to hear.
Yeah. So when did this movement toward the kind of integration that you're talking about begin?
Well, so we started in 1985, and there were a few places around then that were trying this. I think there was more activity in the 90s, and then it really picked up after 2000. There began to be more studies showing that it cost less, that it kept people out of the hospital, that some of the outcomes were better. And so things have been rapidly accelerating since then, but it's a relatively new movement, and we certainly don't have all the operational parts of it worked out. It's hard to you know, you need some training. If you're already trained in a more traditional mental health, it's good to get some training and supervision in a medical setting rather than just hoping to apply what you already know, because it really is kind of a different world.
Well, to that point, you developed a primary care postdoc. You mentioned the postdoc earlier. You developed one for health professionals and mental health professionals. And in sort of broad strokes, what's the structure of that?
So we have a two-year primary care psychology postdoc. We have four postdocs a year, and they come together in psychiatry. It's headquartered in psychiatry, and their clinical work, however, is in, we have two of them that work in pediatrics. One works in OBGYN, and another works in internal medicine and family medicine. So the applied part of their training is done in primary care settings with supervisors in a primary care setting. So that those postdocs have a lot of, it's a terrific postdoc at this point. We've been doing it since about 1987. So we've had plenty of time to refine it so that it really is a good educational experience. We also have, for, you know, people who can't come and spend 2 years with us, we have 5 days every year in June that we do an intensive training for whoever wants to come. And that is multidisciplinary, so it can be any discipline. And it's a medical family therapy and integrated care intensive, like I said, for 5 days. It's in June. So I live in Rochester, New York, and it's not snowing in June. it's really, that we'll be doing it for our 21st year. Maybe it's our 22nd year next June. So yeah. we also have that kind of finely tuned. I think it's an experience that everybody enjoys. So that's also an opportunity for people if they're interested in doing some intensive training, more than just a couple hour workshop, but really don't want to, you know, leave home and go do a postdoc somewhere.
Yeah, that sounds really exciting. Now, I gather that family therapy played an important role in this movement of integration, and it sounds like it also was key in your own training.
So I would say there's two strands of psychology in particular that have fed into integrated care. One is sort of the CBT, individually focused health psychology, people who I think bring a lot to the table. My own strand has been more family systems, and especially in primary care, I think family systems is a really great training for primary care, because so often the problems that come to primary care are undifferentiated, they're complicated, sort of medical, individual, and family/community problems. There's often elements of all those things thrown in to a patient's, for example, recurring headaches that haven't remitted with the usual treatment. And so a systems perspective allows you to both see the patient in the context of his or her system, but it also gives you a particular lens with which to look at the healthcare system. For example, the team functioning. Teams function a lot like families function. It's helpful to know something about that when you're trying to be useful in that situation. So I find it very valuable. Our primary care fellowship trains people in both family therapy and primary care psychology because they're so intertwined in our location.
Well, when it comes to family systems therapy, is there a particular school of thought or theorist or practitioner that you were influenced by?
So when I did my internship at University of Texas Medical Branch, a a psychologist named Harold Galician and his, at that time, much younger colleague, Harlene Anderson, were my teachers. And at that point in time, they were associated with what's called strategic family therapy. As time has gone on, Harry died maybe, I forget, 10 or 15 years ago, and Harlene's become a very prominent person in the narrative therapy world, and she and I are still close friends and colleagues. And I think what I learned from them was a lot of attention to language and how people use language and how to facilitate hearing people's stories in a way that might help them construct a healthier story. And, you know, some of the paradoxes that are essential in all human life. So that was my internship. When I did my postdoc, which was also in family therapy, I worked with them a day a week, but I also worked with a person named Glenn Cambor, who was an analyst in Houston and also a sort of graduate of Murray Bowen training. Mm-hmm. So I got a pretty heavy dose of Bowenian approaches, and I think those two combined together fairly well, and that's really what I brought to the healthcare setting.
Okay.
I will mention that, you know, all that, like which school and all that, I think in family therapy for students now is kind of maybe historically of some interest, but not so relevant because so many of the theories are integrated. And a few years ago, Bill Doherty and I wrote a slim book for APA Publications called Family Therapy, and just tried to say, you know, where are we now with family therapy? If we didn't have to say this school and that school and the other school. And so I like that little book. I think it's a pretty good introduction to family therapy as we think about it now.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I was thinking of names like Virginia Satir, Whitaker, Mnuchin.
Right.
And I'm sure I'm leaving other important people out.
Yeah, I will say that after I left postdoc, the person who had just stepped down from being chair of psychiatry here was Lyman Nguyen. And Lyman was one of the first people to start doing family therapy, along with Sal Mnuchin and some of the people in Palo Alto, and also Harry Galician. And he was a schizophrenia researcher. And so Lyman was my mentor until he died, maybe, I've lost track, 10 plus years ago. So I was lucky to, and he was very involved in providing family psychoeducation to patients with psychotic, you know, to families of patients with psychotic disorders. So I was able to work with a lot of different people, and I knew and had some contact with Mnuchin and Whitaker and some of those people, because at that time, they all stayed in close contact with each other.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good thing that if there's a more of a sort of agreement that has emerged, some kind of consensus that moves away from tight allegiance to the schools, I think that's a good thing. And I think it's something that's happening in psychotherapy generally.
Right. I think, you know, we're not good enough at changing human behavior at this point to say that anybody's got the one solution for all problems with all people, you know?
Right. Right. Well, what made you decide to run for APA president?
Well, I'll tell you, it came as something of a surprise to me. I have been active in APA for my whole career, so that part's not a surprise. And I've been on many different and various boards and committees. I know the organization pretty well. And I realized sort of early, late December last year, and then it all sort of came together when I was taking stock of things on January 1st, actually, that I have a lot of contacts in the leadership of various primary care medical organizations, and that I really might be able to use those contacts and my understanding about primary care and the medical and the healthcare system right now to benefit psychology. And that, you know, I would like to do that. I think it's a time when things are very much in flux. How all it will come down with the Affordable Care Act is really unclear. What kind of models people will end up with. And I think it's really super important that psychology be very active right now because we have a lot to contribute. We need to help fashion our nation's new healthcare system and because it's an opportunity for us and our graduates to participate. And as I thought it through, I realized, you know, I really might be able to help with this, and I think I'd like to do that. So that's how it happened.
Yeah, great. Well, is this trend toward integrative care that we've been speaking about unique to the United States?
It's not, actually. And I've had the great pleasure over the past, I don't know, since about 93, opportunity to travel around the world and speak and try to help with other countries' integrated care programs. And something that's very much surprised to me is how similar, regardless of culture, financing of healthcare, language, you name it, how similar the situations are in terms of having mental and physical health be siloed out from each other and not appropriately integrated. And so there's all kinds of experiments and innovative things going on around the world. I've been to several countries in Asia, sometimes more than once, a lot of countries in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe. I've done some work at several points in time in Mexico. I went to Cuba in November of last year and toured their healthcare system, and they have a fair amount of integrated care there. So there's a lot to learn from other countries who are working on this as well, and I think we have something to offer them too.
Mm-hmm. In the presentation that I watched, you cited a fairly appalling figure about where the U.S. healthcare system ranks among other countries in the world.
Right.
Do you recall
37th. Right. So I think that, you know, as can happen when it's easy to get self-satisfied, you know, as an individual or a country, apparently. Our health outcomes, you know, while we have by far the most expensive healthcare system in the world, we do not have the best healthcare outcomes for our citizens. And that's part of what really has to change. We need to spend less and get more out of our healthcare. So countries that most every other country in the world has a very strong primary care base with much less specialty care. And we're the reverse of that. Our system has a huge amount of specialty care, tends to be disconnected from primary care and uncoordinated. Anybody who's then had a particular medical problem and had to go to several different doctors, often being the person that has to tell one doctor what the other doctor said, you know, it's just not a good situation. The Affordable Care Act has various provisions that will try to help with that. For example, electronic health records that all health professionals use, and trying to strengthen our primary care base, but that's really going to take time so that people get to the right level of care. You don't want to go have an MRI that has its own, you know, difficulties, its own morbidities associated with it, if what you really need is an interview and perhaps an exam from a primary care doctor. But, you know, our system is so focused on fee-for-service and profit that it sometimes incents the wrong things in healthcare.
Yeah, I think that's something you talked about was the incentives. And are there models that instead of incenting a fee for forgot how you just referred to it, a fee for
fee
for service. Is there some fee for good results?
Exactly. Well, actually, that is what's happening now. So most countries, the vast majority of countries, have national health care insurance so that the profit margin isn't part of what is driving the health care. And it just isn't a good model when it's associated with health care, perhaps with other things, but not health care. And what's happening now is that physicians and hospitals and other health organizations and therefore other health professionals are starting to be paid for outcomes. So, for example, at our family medicine clinic, we're paid for improvement in our panel of diabetic patients' hemoglobin A1Cs. So if they improve, then we get more money. And if they don't improve, we get less money. And you get paid for both doing the screening and getting the results. So, and at the same time, some providers are being penalized for example, referring for too many CAT scans or something like that. You want to get to a situation where if a patient needs the test or procedure, they get it. And if they really don't need it, they don't get it. And it's going to take some maneuvering of the incentives and some tracking of the outcomes for us to get it right, you know?
Yeah. So what are the opportunities for psychologists, particularly young PhD graduates? A certain percentage of my listeners are in school and in training or hoping to be. So what sorts of opportunities are there?
Well, I would really encourage them to try to get some training in a medical or best primary care setting. And I think that certainly the number of requests I get for psychologists trained in primary care exceeds the number of primary care psychologists we produce. So there are clearly jobs there. I think that if you're not in the place to do a postdoc or whatever, try to watch some webinars. Watch my webinar. It's free. And try to go to some local meetings and trainings about primary care and then begin to express interest. Try to work with some primary care psychologist who is willing to have you shadow them or who might be interested in having you work there for one day a week. I think it's not for everybody, and so you want to make sure it's something that you enjoy. You have to have a certain tolerance for ambiguity to work in primary care, since patients come in with undefined and often vague problems that don't quite fit anybody's diagnostic nomenclature, and it tends to be fast-paced when it's busy.
It doesn't sound boring.
It is the opposite of boring. It's very right. Challenging. It's important to like working around people and working in teams and collaborating. So it really couldn't be farther from sitting in your office waiting for a motivated patient to call you and ask for help.
Yeah. So what sorts of competencies do they need to develop or focus on as they're going through their training?
I think it's helpful to have some background, more than I did when I started this, for sure, in, for example, the biology of the common chronic illnesses. So the common chronic illnesses seen in primary care are things like diabetes, hypertension, asthma, chronic back pain, depression, anxiety. It's helpful to know something about those illnesses and their treatments and what the psychosocial demands are on patients that are coping with those cancer. Now, some of that can be learned on the job because your patients teach you a huge amount and every patient's situation is different, as well as the physician and the team taking care of the patient can really, it, through the collaboration, you probably learn more than you ever will in a book. But it's nice to have some passing understanding about that. It's good to have some understanding of how brief so the evidence base for brief interventions as well as psychotherapy, how that goes with patients who have health challenges. And if you're a family therapist, or even if you aren't, how to take a genogram so that you understand a patient and family's health history, how they tend to cope with health challenges, and can apply that to their current situation. It's helpful to know something about grief and loss, because that is certainly a part of working in healthcare. And have some, you know, get to have some familiarity and comfort level with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's helpful to know how to work with physicians in a way that certainly most of my fellows and other students in the beginning are quite intimidated. And so we do a lot of role play, and I say, just pretend, you know, you don't have to not be intimidated, but don't show it.
Yeah.
And it usually doesn't take too long before they realize they know a huge amount about their topic, much more than the resident or the physician, and that what they have to offer is appreciated. But you have to kind of get over that hump and be willing to not just sit in your office, wherever it is, but go out there and get to know the members of the team and greet patients who might not be expected to see you, how to help them feel comfortable, and how to help them bridge from their definition of the problem to something that includes working with a psychologist.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you've been very active in APA, and you've been on lots of committees, and now you're shooting for the very top office. What are some of the hot button issues before APA right now?
Well, I mean, from my own perspective, healthcare is number one. Really helping shape our healthcare system and helping to participate in our healthcare system. I think working on grant funding, research funding, increase research funding for a wide variety of psychological science is really important. The NIH budget has been flat for a good while, and either flat or going down. And that makes it really hard for us to do the research that is so important, whether it's about healthcare or violence or the many other areas that psychological researchers study. APA is going through an internal reorganization of its governance, and it's such a big organization that that's a huge project. I think no matter what kind, whether practitioner or scientist or professor, we need to get clear about our identity vis-a-vis other professionals, other scientists, other people, and be able to define ourselves clearly and be able to reach out and collaborate with other organizations, whether they're health organizations or science organizations or whatever they are. So I think we've got a lot of difficulties in our country right now, and psychological science and practice has something to offer virtually all of them.
Okay, well, that's an excellent summary. As we wind down, is there anything more that you'd like our listeners to know?
Well, if you're an APA member, I really hope you'll vote. I hope you'll vote for me, but even more than that, I hope you'll participate by voting. Unfortunately, a small percentage of the membership each year votes, and I think that's a shame, because I think it really does matter who is at the top of any organization. If you want to know more about me, my website is www.susanmcdanielforapa.com, and there are a couple of hours of free CE that are on my website, as well as a lot of other information about the campaign and about where I stand on practically you name it issue. I've answered questions that are on the website that you can find under statements and responses. If you're interested in, whether you're a psychologist or not, if you're interested in primary care, please think about coming to our 5-day intensive in June. It's always a really interesting and good time. It's a combination of didactics from a variety of kinds of professionals and ongoing small groups that go throughout the week. So it's a lot of fun.
How would a person find out about that? Where would they go?
You could, I suppose, email me. So my email address is, well, wait a second. Let me, you, why don't you call my assistant? That's a good idea. And I'll also give you my email address. Her number is 585-275-7101. That's 585-275-7101. And my email address is SusanHLikeHouse_McDaniel@URMC, University of Rochester Medical Center, .rochester.edu. And so between one of those two things, we'll be able to send you the link for the intensive, and you can get more information and see if it's something you might be interested in.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that information with us, as well as all the other rich information that you've given us here. And I certainly wish you well in your race for the APA presidency. I'm going to be following that with great interest. So, Dr. Susan McDaniel, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
Unlike so many of my other interviews that have focused on therapeutic techniques and spiritual approaches to healing and so on, today's was a bit different. But I really think it's important to examine the evolving backdrop of psychology in general and clinical practice in particular, and I hope you agree. To me, it's both shameful and embarrassing that healthcare in the U.S. ranks 37th worldwide. It seems like the primary care model, incorporating psychological services that's been pioneered by Dr. McDaniel and others, may have the potential to dig us out of the healthcare hole that we in the United States find ourselves in. From my conversations with my son Jonathan, I can confirm that his experience in a primary care center is very much in line with what Dr. McDaniel described to us. As a nurse practitioner, he finds it fast-paced, demanding, and also very interesting and full of major responsibility and constant new learning. Beyond this, he experiences deep gratification serving a very needy and underserved, mostly ethnic minority population. And once again, synchronicity strikes. Right after the interview, I received an online newsletter from the psychology department at the University of Michigan, where I did my own doctoral work. Now, I can't even recall the last time they sent me a newsletter like this. In fact, I think it might be a new thing they've recently instituted. And as I quickly scan through it, what do I discover? They now offer a biopsychology, cognition, and neuroscience program as a specialty within the PhD in psychology. Wow, how appropriate that I should get their newsletter right now on the heels of this interview. Now, I call that synchronicity. So if you're a student and you're interested in what Dr. McDaniel had to say, and you want to enter a specialization that's crying for new hires, you might want to give my old alma mater very close consideration.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Nikki Amaria Sargent. And I wanted to say thank you. I want to say I was a therapist in a clinical practice in a rural community that for many years, and it didn't have, still doesn't have, much in the way of public mental health resources, let alone training opportunities for its therapists. My personal journey led me into analysis, and then analytic training, and finally to be a certified union analyst. My rural colleague supported me in all of this, despite questioning the relevance and the value of what I was doing. I still live in that country or community, though I practice in Palo Alto. Your podcasts have helped me learn of fields of study and persons of amazingly rich research and competence I know I have enjoyed greatly. I've told my rural cohorts about your interviews. This has helped them grow as clinicians, better serve their patients, understand me, and get CEU units without extensive driving and big carbon footprints. I'm so grateful for all your time and efforts to put together quality programming, bringing the treasures of depth psychology into contemporary discussion, and helping weave together communities of kindred spirits. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Nikki Amaria Sargent. I hope others will be inspired to follow your example. In fact, let me try a little incentive. If you will click on our multicolored support button in the right-hand sidebar on our site and sign up for an ongoing donation of $10 or more and indicate that you're responding to my book offer, I'll send you a brand new copy of Self-Therapy by Dr. Jay Early, my recent guest on Shrink Wrap Radio 419, who you will recall is a practitioner of internal family systems therapy. I'm happy to announce that we have a couple of new transcripts on the site. First, we have a new transcript for number 422, Finding True Refuge in Mindfulness with Tara Brock. In fact, that was last week's interview, and it's already been transcribed in record-breaking time by Gloria Oldman. Thank you, Gloria. We also have a transcript of an older one, number 317, Body Therapy and the Embodied Life with Dr. Stanley Kellerman. And that one is thanks to Joe Kelly in Australia. In fact, both Joe and Gloria Ullman are Australians, so I really have to love my Australian listeners. I've mentioned before that I have a particular affection for the genre known as Nordic noir, and that I got a recommendation from an actual Nordic person, namely Oscar, my Swedish listener friend in Stockholm, and he said that if I liked the Dragon Tattoo series, which I was quite enthralled by, that I should read Arne Dahl. And it so happens that for a while we were able to get some Scandinavian TV mysteries here in the States, and I recalled watching an Arne Dahl series, so I checked on audible.com, and sure enough, they have some of the novels that that series was based on, and Oscar recommended I start with the very first one, which is called Misterioso, and I finished that, and now I'm on to another, the name of which is Bad Blood. So Oscar, once again, thanks so much for that recommendation. The book is unabridged, and so you'll be able to get a bit over 10 hours of audio entertainment. One of the things I like about these Scandinavian novels is that they give so many insights into the social issues that that part of the world struggles with, issues such as a flood of immigration from Eastern Europe, incursions by the Russian mafia attempting to seize control of legitimate businesses and institutions, struggles against human trafficking, drugs, resurgent Nazism, and religious extremism, among others. And even though the novels are fiction, I believe they're factual in their portrayal of the underbelly in that part of the world. Fascinating stuff to me. Now, you can get this audiobook for free with no obligation to continue by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And if you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that we have an app for that. That is for listening to these shows and communicating with me. And you can find full details on our site under the apps tab. Finally, my obsession with sound quality and microphones continues unabated. The latest is that I've added a mixer to to my podcasting setup. In a way, I've come full circle. I used to use a mixer in the early years of the show. Then somehow I decided I didn't need one and sold the one I had. And so now I had to go out and buy a new one. Sometimes I drive myself crazy. Anybody know a good therapist?
Hi, this is Kira Van Nuys Martin, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Kira. Hey, as I mentioned last time, I could use some fresh transitions. So how about recording your own version of You're on the Couch with Dr. Dave so we can have more variety? Now let's turn to some recent email from our listener community. And first we hear from Dante, who writes, Dear Shrink, I want to thank you for your program. I can't tell you how much your various podcasts have helped me over the last few years. I'm an orthopedic surgery resident in New York City and listen to your program while running or on the way to and from work. The Mindfulness and Resilience program with Linda Graham really struck a chord with me and has continued to resonate with me over the last several months while going through a particularly challenging time. This episode is so full of material and ideas which I have found invaluable in dealing with my daily emotional, personal, professional, and spiritual experiences. You see, my spiritual background is one of a very Taoist and meditative practice, while my professional life has produced a strong authoritative role and figure of power, which I often struggle with. This is often unnatural, so I've worked very hard to create a professional leadership role, which is also at peace with the environment and which can be efficient and productive. At the same time, my personality can't seem to just let go and be in the background during this time of residency where I need to serve as the chief in my day-to-day practice. I find it critical to be a leader in this time and truly enjoy leading and teaching. Many of Linda Graham's recommendations for day-to-day practice, as well as some of Dr. Siegel's exercises, have provided such a solidity and strength to my foundation of inner peace and balance in these times. These programs I often listen to over and over again and find new exercises and ideas that help me eternally along my journey. I thank you dearly, warmly, and that's from Dante. Well, Dante, I'm really so happy to hear that Shrinkwrap Radio has served you in such a deep and important way. I can really understand the challenges that you face as the head resident in a busy Manhattan hospital. And I think that today's interview will be particularly relevant to you since it captures much of that kind of energy, I think. So I hope you will continue to find nourishment here, and I'll keep you in mind as I make future selections for guests. Next, we hear from Tony J. in Melbourne, Australia, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. Just up a ladder, pruning a rather large hedge, and listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. Spring has pretty much sprung in Australia, so things are getting busy in the garden. Once again, I wanted to pass on my appreciation for all your hard work. Your podcast series continues to inspire and enlighten. Your podcasts have been such a valuable resource for me while studying at the university. Your series allows my knowledge base to grow even whilst I'm at work. Cannot count the amount of trees pruned, weeds pulled, and hedges I have shaped whilst listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Your work fills my days with meaning. And again, that's from Tony J. in Melbourne, Australia. And Tony, your words fill my day with meaning. And I really appreciate your response and your letting me know of it. And as I said to the previous writer, I'll do my best to keep that good stuff coming your way. Finally, let's do just one more. This one is from Andrea H., who writes, Hello, Dr. Dave. I listen to your podcast regularly and greatly enjoy it, although I do not work within the field of psychology per se. I do work with the public. Much of your information has been useful to me. In your most recent podcast, you mentioned your conundrum regarding setting up a paywall. I wanted to say that I'm glad that you are keeping your content free so that it is accessible to as many people as possible. However, if you are in need of money to keep the podcast and website going, have you considered advertisements? Many free podcasters use advertisement or advertisement to pay for their content. They have banners linking to Amazon.com on their webpages, or they do a short commercial at the beginning or end of their podcast. It's not very obtrusive, and maybe it could help. Just an idea. Thank you again for your information. A donation will be coming your way soon. And that's from Andrea H., who I note is has after her name MPH, that's a master's in public health, and she's also an RN. So I think today's content will be especially interesting to you, Andrea. And Andrea didn't realize it, and maybe it's because so many people don't actually go to the website but listen on a mobile device. I don't know if that was the case with Andrea or not. But in fact, and she may be a rather new listener, in the early days I did carry ads that often played at the beginning of the episode. And of course, I have been doing advertising. I do make books available through Amazon.com, and you're hearing my ads for Audible.com. So it's a good idea, and I thank you for that. So with that, we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on my message phone at 415-830-4014. You can also leave voicemails using that iPhone/Android app that I mentioned earlier. Thanks again to Dr. Susan H. McDaniel for bringing us up to speed on the role of psychology in primary care. And by the way, I just cast my vote for her in the APA presidential election. My next episode will feature an interview with Dr. Bonnie Badenoch, an author and authority in the exploding area of interpersonal neurobiology. You won't want to miss it. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.